All right, welcome to the pre-show. We have with us our friend and really a colleague, because he has his own website and does his brew reviews as well, from 16 hours into the future, Greg from New Zealand. Greg, welcome.
Thanks very much, Greg. It's great to be here in the future.
Right across the international dateline. Now, Greg is joining us for two reasons. One, because we like him. He's our friend.
And
we like having people to join us, because this is sometimes a solitary show, and we get lonely. And the other thing is that we've been having a discussion over the emails about gun control. And he has a differing perspective from both Jeff and I, and I thought we should bring that in and discuss it, because it's best to discuss it, because we were doing it in text space, and it was hard to get out everything, because we live in this world where we can communicate with each other with voice and bit and sounds to each other, and we don't live in the world where we used to, where you can only do text, I think. And that means that we've lost some of the ability to get our points across in text as well as we can in voice.
Or is it, I guess that's some of it. The other part might be that, you know, why use all that effort for the low bandwidth communication when we can just, hey, Skype New Zealand and have the high bandwidth communication.
Another reasonable point.
I think that's spot on. It's just cumbersome email these days, isn't it?
Yeah, it was hard to get everything out, and it was hard to do a sort of real time. You know, you can't do real time communication, and that really is you know, the purpose of this. So,
Greg, can you go into your audio settings and turn down your mic level like about a third, a quarter?
I sure can. Hang on. Oh, great. If it hasn't run off the planet. No, here we go. Does that make a difference?
Yeah, that's a little bit better. That's good. We can deal with that. Okay. All right, so, you know, we've been conversing for a while now, and
move it back so he can see.
We've kind of lost the
hey.
Greg's like initial Greg from New Zealand's initial thing was, you know, he was listening to us, our conversation, and he found himself yelling at his iPhone.
It's reasonable. I would expect that to happen most of the time.
I wasn't overly serious about that.
But it's a point, you know, and mm-hmm. That's why I felt like he had to chime in, because he, you know, disagreed with what we were saying. And so, Greg, can you give us a brief recap of your opening argument, if you will?
Sure. I guess I was coming at it from a classical liberal background. I was raised in a very sort of, I guess you'd call it, right wing leaning household, Republican over there, if you like. And as I grew up and, you know, went out and actually saw what the world was like, I became almost entirely the opposite. I would have voted Democrat if I was in the States. And then just through argument and generally being convinced by people smarter than me and more argumentative and persuasive than me, I decided that the answer is really neither. And I guess I come at almost everything now from a classical liberal / libertarian viewpoint. So I look at everything not as a what should we do to fix a problem, but perhaps is it right to do anything at all other than make sure that people respect each other via the laws that are in place and via the fact that we're all human beings together. So that really is the foundation of classical liberal politics, and that no one initiates force against anyone else, and that's what a government is there for, to stop force being initiated against you, and in the case where you can't stop it, to deal with the consequences.
Okay, that's a reasonable summation of your point. That's just... Before we go on, I just want Jeff to sort of play with the settings a little bit, because, again, you're still a little bit loud, and I think we can do that, something on our end to fix that.
I might be able to... I was doing my system settings rather than my Skype settings. Let me just...
There we go.
I found the way to change the volume of the Skype output. You don't have to change anything. You're right in line with our levels now, so that'll make things a lot easier to compress down.
Sorry for deafening any listeners.
So,
if they haven't gone deaf from our show, then
yeah. So, I understand where you're coming from, because I used to hold beliefs very similar to yours. My beliefs have changed considerably over the past, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, but basically since when we started doing the show. I understand the classic libertarian perspective, and I find it faulty. And the reason I find it faulty is because I think that it and I tried to explain this to you, and I don't think I did a very good job, but my feeling is that liberty and freedom are not necessarily the same thing. So this is going into some weird political philosophy, but I'll see if I can bring my point. So there's this the libertarian philosophy is that if you increase liberty, you increase freedom. It's a one-to-one relationship, essentially. I don't think that's necessarily true, and I think that you can look into our past, and I'm coming at this from an America-centric place, but I think you can look to our past and show examples of this. For example, one of the worst decisions ever made by the Supreme Court, I think unanimously, is the Dred Scott decision, that basically said that people of a different skin color were property. They were not allowed to vote. They were not endowed with the rights in the Constitution. And so this was we fought a civil war over this. The next decision to sort of modify that was Plessy versus Ferguson. And that made separate but equal. So that made racial discrimination completely legal. And what that did is that really upped the liberty equation. You could simply say, no blacks can go into my store. You could say no blacks could go here. You could, and so if you have that, your liberty is upped, but you don't necessarily up freedom just by doing that.
But the problem with that is that you have effectively set a precedent for the removal of liberty by having that law. If there was no law at all, I agree that a person should be free to ban anyone they want from their store on any basis they like. Hey, they might not like skinny white people, so no skin, like that's, I'd ban skinny white people. They make me feel bad. I'm a fat white guy. We've got to have only skinny white people so I can feel comfortable. As soon as the law says, you know, separate but equal, I can't even correlate those two things in my head. That doesn't make sense to me. If the law is saying it's okay and they are separate and it's okay to separate, that's what people will do. If you don't have a law there at all, I think people will naturally realize that it's a pretty abominable thing to do to each other, and you won't go to stores that decide they're going to segregate.
I'd like to think that, but I think that another problem you're dealing with here is that it's a society with limited resources. So it's not like there are unlimited places to get goods. So perhaps you can the only shoe stores that are in a reasonable area won't accept you. You have just, you know, lost a considerable amount of freedom, even though other people have their liberty moved up. So if you were to say, like, because that was Plessy versus Ferguson was overturned in Brown versus Board of Education. So the Civil Rights Act and all this other stuff. So we don't have to worry about that going on right now. But there's still obviously other terms of discrimination. I mean, like, we have sexual discrimination. We have discrimination of all types. If your resources are limited, then you are limiting freedom by upping that liberty quotient. And that's the problem. So does that make any sense? Am I making sense here?
I think I understand what you're saying. Hang on, let me. One of the implications of what you're saying to me, and tell me if I get this wrong, is that you're saying by the... No, I can't do it. you seem to be saying that me choosing not to go into a store that's segregated is then limiting my freedom to shop. Is that what you're getting at by that?
No,
that was.
I'm saying that the store owner choosing to not serve you, and having the ability to not serve you, would be fine if there was a store right next door that would serve you and do exactly the same as that store did, and you had an equal opportunity to choose both stores. But that's not the case.
But the store doesn't exist in a vacuum either. It exists in a place in a society where pressure will be exerted on him to serve you.
Well, the question is, do we do we as a society try to make strides to make sure that thing doesn't happen, or do we simply let it happen via inertia and see whether which one is the better option? Can we jiggle things a little bit, not make things, you know, not to get it back into the gun realm? Jeff and I are not suggesting banning guns altogether. We're suggesting jiggling things. And we're not, the other thing we're not suggesting is that any of these changes will be effective.
So here's a question. I haven't had, we were just really deep into civil rights and liberty versus freedom.
Right.
I'm having a hard time, and maybe there isn't a segue into it, but equating what you just said about civil rights to gun rights. I'm having a hard time drawing that correlation, well, the direct correlation.
The question of your right to have a firearm is a civil right.
That's right. You, in theory, the principles we were talking about, whether you agree with it or not, is if you're free to have free speech, if you're free to for the color of your skin not to matter in daily discourse with people, if you're free to go out and buy any beer you like, you're also free to own any gun you like. The problem comes in when you limit someone else's freedom to do the same by the use of speech, throwing beer at them, shooting a gun in their face, whatever you want to do.
And I understand that perspective, but a good corollary to this, and I apologize because this is not an original argument. This is something that I actually picked up from The Daily Show.
Oh, I don't think any of these arguments are original. They're just ones we wanted to have.
But they point out that, you know, it's true. We had and still do have a drunk driving problem in this country. And over the course of the last 30 years, there's been various legal things and other options to try to remedy this, and in better enforcement, making sure that bartenders are not allowed to serve, you know, legally, you know, drunk patrons. We didn't make alcohol illegal, but we made reasonable restrictions, and we also did a bunch of campaigns. And over the course of 30 years, there's been, comparing today to 30 years ago, it's 200% difference in terms of the rate of drunk driving. So there is something to say for that kind of movement, of that kind of, you know, you're not outright banning things, but you are making small changes that hopefully will have aggregate changes down the line. And you're doing it in a way that the intention is not to deny people's civil rights, but simply to make things safer for the aggregate.
Mm. Okay, so two things to that point. The first is that it's a great example, and the reason it's a great example is because I think it actually plays to my argument as much as yours. Okay. I would argue that it's not the legislation, it's not the tweaking that's done it, it's the gradual social awareness of that it's not acceptable to drive drunk that's the problem.
I agree.
And effectively, all of these enforcement things and so on like that, they're just catching people. I actually think there are probably more people driving less people driving drunk, in other words, more people behaving with respect to their fellow humans than there were before. And I would say that probably would have happened without the legislation, but with education and with just general social awareness that that's a bad thing to do. And the same thing's happened here in New Zealand. The second thing that I was going to say about that is that it's exactly the same argument again. With respect to guns. Now, I think that libertarians are often painted as not crazy. Well, probably crazy. You guys have got the Tea Party over there, right? And they're all, okay, they're
nuts. That's morphing into something far beyond libertarianism.
Yeah, I think they started with the right idea and they went nut job, but mm-hmm. But what happens is that there's often this view, and a lot of libertarians I know are like this, they paint this big caricature of government as out to ban everything and restrict fun and just be evil. I don't believe in evil. I honestly think that governments want, you know, people get into office because they genuinely want to help you. The problem is they realize once they're there, they have to play the game. They have to get more votes. They have to stay there. And how do you do that? You make reactive law that makes people feel good after a tragedy. You try to make them feel safer. They may not be any safer. Greg, in your email, you were talking about confidence, and that's exactly what I think they try to give. But I would argue that back to your point, that it's the awareness around drunk driving, and it's the awareness around guns, and it's the fact that if we as a society stop tolerating it just by our own interactions with each other, that will have far more effect than any tweaking of any legislation could ever do.
I agree, absolutely agree, fundamentally, that societal change is far more effective than legislative change. I just completely agree with you there. But I think that legislative change can help give that a push, can help push that in the right direction. And of course, who's right direction is a reasonable question. But I mean, we see now something that sort of a real embracement of a real radicalized gun culture, and it's kind of. It could be something that is just news, you know, just the way that the news networks do it, and that's why it seems so up in our face. But it is kind of frightening to me, and it's frightening the way in which, you know, we read about certain things that are happening with gun culture right now. Just the very idea that maybe you wouldn't be able to get 30-round magazines and shift it to 10 is causing people to start stockpiling weapons and talking about seceding from the Union. There's something wrong here, and there's something that can't just be, you know, oh, let's talk about it like you and I are talking about it, and like, you know, most reasonable people will talk about it. There's something that has to be done to push this, to make this more, you know, apparent that we need to do this. And that's part of my point.
Look, I you're absolutely right. And I, as I say, I'm an ignorant Kiwi. I have no idea why the culture is the way it is there. I don't know why people are so obsessed with guns. I love that you have the freedom to have them. I don't like at all what it seems to have done to the mindset. That said, I don't know. Maybe the answer is talking to them. Maybe we need to, you know, a society is made up of individuals acting freely in ways that benefit themselves, and benefiting everyone else is a way to benefit yourself. Why? Maybe we need to reach out to these people more. I say we, I mean you.
Yeah. It's our problem. That's for sure.
Yeah, so, Greg, it's everyone's problem. I mean, I said to you in an email, and I wasn't kidding. I was sitting with my in-laws when Sandy Hook happened, and I was struggling. I was, you know, fighting back tears. It was really upsetting. It's not just a US problem. We see this. It could happen anywhere. There was that shooting in, where was it, Norway? Crazy right-wing guy? Yeah, mm-hmm. It was Norway not long ago. And that had nothing at all to do with the US, and it was equally as affecting. We've had ones here. There was a shooting, and it was, it was years ago, but it was one of the first things I remember seeing on the news covered with the big news cycle thing that just didn't stop. And 10 civilians and civil police officers were shot, and it was just absolutely horrific. It's not a unique culture to the US, but it just seems magnified more there.
So, but, you know, again, this brings up, and I'm sorry, Jeff, you had something to say. I don't want to jump in.
I did. It was, so you mentioned about people that are really up in arms about losing their 30-round clips and stuff.
Right.
You know, and it's the clips you've seen on The Daily Show. It's clips from conservative talk radio.
It's going to Drudge Report, going to Weekly Standard, going to, because I do like to vary my reading, looking at the Washington Times, looking at the conservative news organization, not just Fox News, not just the clips I see on The Daily Show, but actually reading the stuff that's out there.
Right. I'm just saying that, you know, it's very possible that there's a distortion field that, you know, is, I mean,
I did say that this could all be media. This could be,
I mean, because certainly, you know, an attack on guns is conservative talk radios. That's bigger than a black Muslim being elected to the White House. I mean, if not, it's just as close for conservative talk radio. I mean, it is gold for those guys. Right. And they're going to make every penny they can.
No, it's absolutely true. It's you know, they're feeding the beast. And even as their beast has gotten smaller and smaller, it's gotten more rabid. So they're able to mm-hmm. feed it more and more and get the same amount of money from it.
And it is a feedback loop, isn't it? The more they report, the more we see it, and the more part of that actually becomes the problem.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I mean, so the question is, how do you counter that effectively? How do you counter that through simple talking? These are the way it's set up now. They're not going to listen.
Is there not a free market in radio? More craft beer radio.
There it is.
I'm only partially joking here. I mean, you could, you know, that why isn't everyone out? Well, I guess I haven't really heard many sane views from either side of the debate on this one, but why aren't you guys out there having this discussion? Not to make it absolutely your responsibility and your right. problem, but why aren't there more people with rational, sane views?
You know, so something that I see is, you know, the conservative talk radio is entertainment, but it doesn't play itself off like entertainment. Like
right.
the opposite side, conservative talk radio and The Daily Show are almost the same thing. The Daily Show plays itself off as entertainment where you might learn something, and conservative talk radio plays itself off as dead serious, you're going to be living in a cesspool, you know, type thing.
While it's just entertainment. So it's yeah. It's infotainment. It's entertainment masquerading as news.
But one of the most powerful things I've ever seen on The Daily Show, it was years ago, but it was Jon Stewart like pleading with conservative radio, like, you're hurting America, please stop. And you know, I really subscribe to that because it's almost like a brainwashing. It's, you know, the people that are listening are the people that want to hear this, that agree with that point of view, but the radio is just reinforcing it, and it's making a monster out of something that is small or nothing. And it's sad.
And, you know, even more important than people's people's love of guns here is the people's love of freedom of speech. So the idea, and we've had polarized media before. It has never been as pervasive as it is today, but I mean, the idea of a undecided media or a media that is, you know, just straight telling news is actually a relatively new invention. But where was I going with this? Somewhere. I had a point. It's lost to the wilderness.
I have that problem all the time.
So the question is, when you have these reinforcing pockets that can't be broken through rational discourse, and, you know, simply doing education merely solidifies something, and you know, like this, the recent Sandy Hook thing happened because, or at least this guy had access to those guns because his mother, who purchased the guns legally, was one of these people who listened to Right Wing Radio and was getting ready for the apocalypse and secession. Now, it doesn't mean that every situation is going to be the same, nor that every tragedy is going to happen. But
so let's legislate right-wing radio. Right?
No. But the point is that when you have this thing, when you have this sort of reaction, I think these other things become more likely to happen.
I think there's a flaw in the reasoning there, though. I take what you're saying, but I don't think you can say Sandy Hook happened because any one thing. I mean, let's say his mother wasn't a prepper. Let's say she was a perfectly safe citizen who just happened to have a gun locked away. And let's say it wasn't a, what was it, Jeff, AR something?
AR-50.
I'm not up with guns.
AR-15.
AR-15, yeah. 15. Let's say it was a small handgun that held six bullets. And he managed to get hold of that somehow. He picked the lock. He got the gun. Would we still be having the same discussion? The intent to harm would have still been there, and he would have found a way to do it.
There's no such thing as an AR-50, Greg.
All right, hold on.
Greg doesn't know guns, but he is positive that the gun the guy has is an AR-50, 50-50. There's no such thing.
Yeah, AR-50.
15 sounded.
That's not what he had. That's a sniper rifle. Pictures down there are sniper rifles. That's not what he had.
Oh, that is a sniper rifle, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. AR-15. Just right. Okay. No.
You can talk about all the theoretical physics you want. But
it's true.
You
it's
do
true.
Need to defer to me.
Yes.
For guns, especially when I'm positive of it.
Yeah. No. Jeff's right. Jeff is absolutely right. And
so did you guys hear about the shooting that happened on Thursday or Friday at a school?
Something about that.
So some kid said it was because he was being bullied. He took a shotgun into school and shot the kid in the chest. So the kid's in critical condition. I don't think he died. So the thing I was thinking about, you know, Greg and I were talking about, okay, Greg McGill in New Zealand, you know, is strongly opposed, you know, to taking away any of the liberties. So I'm not sure you were for, you know, the assault weapons ban and the large round magazines. But, you know, last week on the show, Greg and I kind of said, you know, I can't make an argument why we need the large round magazines. And Greg, one second, I want you to make your argument why it's a bad idea to legislate against those. But this shooting was a hunting shotgun. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking at this, I'm like, I personally don't want to pass any legislation that would have prevented that.
I agree. So, and I think that one of the points that I think I made in the email was, and to you, was that the point of the legislation is not to prevent the ability for somebody to kill somebody else. You know, as I said to Greg in the email, that's, you know, the price we pay to have this freedom is that people, you know, can do that sort of thing. But the ability to kill 27 people mm-hmm. within a minute and a half very easily is something that maybe needs to be looked at. Greg, your thoughts?
I still feel that that's making reactive law. And even let's just say I agree with you, and we do.
What law isn't reactive?
Law shouldn't be reactive. Law should be proactive. Law should be based on firm, solid principles that always will apply to everyone equally. And then if a case comes along and you feel like, oh, I was hard done by, you may be hard done by, but that's where the price of freedom thing comes up. If the same law applies, will always apply to the same people in the same way, then it's probably good law. And typically that sort of law is not made in a reaction to anything. If you can come up with an example of a good law, well, what you consider a good law that's been made as a reaction against an event, I'd be surprised.
Well, I mean, okay, you presented me with the
hard
problem. Yes, hard to do on the spot. But the reason why I would say that, I mean, it's not necessarily true, is because I think that the law is not a reaction to Sandy Hook. The point is, we're also just having discussion about the law.
Yeah, there is
nothing,
no law.
There is no law.
We're talking theoretically.
Yeah, but if a law were passed to make it so you can't have high-capacity magazines pass a certain limit, that you also made the point in your emails, and I want to make sure this point is brought up. You made the point, who decides that limit? Who decides how many bullets? Who decides how many magazines? Who decides what's a gun? And, you know, it's a good question. It's also something to be considered. But the point is that the law is not a response to a particular tragedy. The law is a response to the fact that these tragedies can occur and are occurring at seemingly larger rates. So it's a response to the fact that we have military-style weapons out there that people are able to stockpile and use in this manner, not a response to a particular event.
Now,
so it is global, and it's not local.
Yeah. But is it happening at an increasing rate, or is it just that it's being reported on more frequently? And the population is growing, so it's happening at the same rate, but you're seeing it statistically the same amount of times. I don't know. That's a question I would like to know. But
it's a question I don't have an answer to.
Yeah. I've seen arguments from both sides of the debate throwing out stats left, right, and center, which is why I tend to stay away from them, because,
well, you know, the
you can use
humans,
them to prove anything you want.
Humans don't get statistics very well, mm-hmm. you know, and
no.
There's been a anomaly, right, where there's been two shootings with very high casualty rates. Frequently, you got the Aurora, Colorado, and the Sandy Hook mm-hmm. one, and that's really all people remember,
right?
And know, you know, if you ask them what the next shooting before that was, you know, a lot of people have hard times figuring out what it was. But because, you know, how many people died in Aurora? It was
something in the 20s, I think, maybe. At least 20 were injured, at least.
Yeah,
yeah. So
I
mean,
think it might have only been 8 or 9 dead, but I can't remember.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so two. What's the adjective I want to use? I was going to say successful, but maybe horrific's the better one to say.
Yeah.
Two horrific shootings in a row is why this is so big right now.
Yeah.
Well, that and the dude was shooting 6-year-olds.
Right. And I came up with an example for you in this time. We can link the Equal Rights Amendment, which I think that we all agree is a good thing, expanding rights for everybody. We can link that to Rosa Parks. It's sitting, you know, on in the bus where she wasn't able to. And so, you know, we can link to specific events, even though it's a tangle and a mess, and it, you know, and that's not to say that society wouldn't have changed ultimately had we not responded in the way to Rosa Parks, but it is that there are catalysts. We can point to catalysts. We can point to significant events that do cause things to change for good or for worse. And that's where the question of science came in, because we actually were talking a little bit about science in this too, and the idea, not that sociology is a hard science by any means, but that we can continue to experiment and continue to try things and try to make things better and see if these things work or not.
I didn't really address that point a lot. I mean, I think I agreed with you conceptually that it sounds great. The problem is, and you just touched on it, that sociology is not a hard science. And you can experiment all you like, but you're still going to stuff it up, for want of a better term, for a large number of people while you're doing so, which is why I honestly believe the best law is the least law. It's the law that sits back and makes sure that you're secure within your rights without forcing anyone else to do anything. And this is where I'm really surprised, based on the founding of the US. And, you know, I'm a massive fanboy of Thomas Jefferson. I'd sleep with the guy if he was here right now. he got one thing he got wrong was slavery. And mm-hmm. the fact that there had to be a law passed to allow equal rights was a massive problem. It was almost like they had these principles, they applied them really consistently, and then just threw them out the window when they allowed slaves. And
it goes to the problem that we talked about, where people aren't rational. I mean, people are rational to a point, and then they start to think they're a lot more rational than they are.
Was there a lobby? I mean, I'm trying to think back to that point in time, but I mean, if there's already plantations, there's already people with vested interest to keep slaves, right?
Well, there absolutely. So, I mean, the Northern Territories did not allow slavery. There absolutely was a lottery, and it was a major political consideration, and that's why the Three-Fifths Compromise was made.
Right.
Which this might be, I don't know if you know this, Greg, but in the Constitution, people of color, black people, are defined as only 3/5 of a person.
Yes, I do, and I think that the problem with slavery was, at the time, there were two misconceptions. One is that the colored people were not equal. Which is where it became okay to treat them as property, and two, that they were, you know, white civilization thought they were rescuing them and bringing them to a better life, and so, you know, what's being kept as a slave, that's okay. You know, they probably thought they were doing a good thing, but it's horribly wrong, and if they'd just applied the principles that they talked about all the time, they would have seen that from day one.
And so the question is, what 100 years from now, are they going to look back and say, is horribly wrong about what we're doing right now?
And but what we're doing right now is adding law. But what we're talking about doing right now is adding law. It's not a fundamental problem with existing law.
See, I don't think that's true, because I think that the way society has developed has made it so that these, you know, your principles don't quite work. And while I, you know, am in, you know, broadly supportive of your basic principles, I don't think that when you have a society as interconnected and as weaved together as ours is now, it can work the same way as when you had essentially smaller plots of people that were not nearly as connected. That's just an observation I'm making, and I don't know whether it's necessarily true or not, but that's my opinion on it.
Well, no, I think it's absolutely true. The trick is how you react to that, or how one should react to that. If you are, as you say, you're broadly supportive of the principles, you just don't think they work in practice. And I can relate, but you've got two options at that point. You can throw your principles out the window, and you can say, oh, well, I'll just give in and we'll make whatever laws I happen to think are best at any given point in time, or you stick to your principles and you do what we're doing now and you try and discuss them and get them out there and, you know, just slowly change opinions. And I think that's that might happen. I actually do. We come from a more liberal time, and I feel that we may be moving into a more liberal time, and I can only hope that is the case.
Jeff? Nothing?
You got nothing.
And on that, the only thing I'm thinking about in the back of my head, you know, I was going to try to steer the conversation here shortly, is video games, first-person shooters and things like that, and the effect that has on...
deserves to be part of the discussion.
Yeah,
I think the fetishization of violence in our culture is something that you know. I don't think video games themselves are the problem, and I have a story about this to tell you later. But I don't think video games themselves are the problem. I think that the way that the society in general fetishizes violence and as opposed to the way it's at least here in America very puritanical about sex. When really it should be the opposite, right? I mean, sex should be the thing that is allowed and fetishized because it's helpful and it's productive and it actually is, you know, life affirming and all that stuff. And violence is not.
Well, it's natural. I mean, we all want to have sex. We all think about sex all the time. I would argue no child thinks about killing all the time. You have to learn that. And once you've learned it and it's become a part of society, be it fetishized or whatever, how do you unlearn it? I don't think you can ban games, and I know you're not even suggesting that, but how do you unlearn it? How do we get rid of that from the culture?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my personal opinion is that first-person shooters definitely do desensitize people. You know, I don't know how to put words really behind this, but, you know, I'm not saying it makes it easy to go out there and kill a real person, but it definitely changes. There's something that goes on. I mean, I think there's just something.
Well, there
changes.
Have been intensive. So this is something that you're getting to an area that I do know a little bit about. I don't have the numbers on me, but I have read about this, and there have been studies that, the most extensive studies do not show a correlation between video games and violence. They do, however, show a slight inclination roughly 10 or 15 minutes after you play the game towards a more violent action than you would not playing the game or playing a farming game or something along those lines. So there's an effect sort of right afterwards. But that goes away or that falls off statistically.
I see.
As time goes on.
I have a terrifying anecdote for you guys on that one. I used to play in a band up in Auckland, which is about, we weren't based in Auckland, but one of the band members was, and he had a large practice space. So we'd drive up there. It's about 90 minutes drive. We'd get there, we'd play all day practicing, and then we'd go and blow off some steam down the arcade. And we'd jump in these car simulators that were at the time. I think the game was Daytona. You guys might remember it.
Oh, probably. Yeah, sure. Great game. Yeah. Oh, I loved it.
And we'd go nuts. We'd just be smashing each other off the track. And, you know, the whole point of it was basically just to smash each other off the road rather than try and win the race. Mm-hmm. And then we'd climb in Paul's car and he would blat back down the motorway way faster and way more recklessly than he'd been driving on the way there. So, Greg, I totally agree with what you're saying because I've seen it. I know it happens. But I would also agree that I don't think games cause you to be violent, but they can certainly change the way that your brain works in the short term.
Right.
You know, there could be a correlation is not causality type thing too. You know, more aggressive people could be drawn to playing first-person shooters and things like that too.
Right. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
So it could be the opposite. It could be, you know, oh, this dude who shot up this school played video games. Well, he was predisposed to liking those kinds of video games instead of Farmville, you know.
Before video games, it would have been comic books or that was a big, you know, in the 70s, comic books were horrible. Or, violent
Dungeons
movies.
Dungeons & Dragons was the classic.
Oh,
as well.
Yeah, Dungeons & Dragons.
Because I used to play that. I am that much of a nerd.
I wish I played.
I never had friends that had played it. So
I've been listening to Dan Harmon's podcast, Harmontown. He's been playing a game of Dungeons & Dragons on it. In bits and pieces, but it sounds like a heck of a lot of fun. As long as you have somebody good as a DM, you're just goofing around and playing around and making up a story.
It's interactive fiction without a computer.
Right. There's, I mean, the, to me, when he's playing, I wish I could play. I wish I knew people who played D&D so I could join in on that, because it sounds like a heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah. But, you know, back to video games. I mean, I'm a horrible wuss. Whenever I play anything, I always play as the good guy. You know, there's no reason to. I should be getting out there and getting down with my bad self. And instead, I'm always like, oh, no, I've upset this guy. I better go and find him an item so he likes me again. I hope I'm not like that in real life.
You're a pleaser.
Yeah. I'd buy them a beer if I could.
I think that you're following your principles. Your principle is, I want this guy to, you know, this guy probably wants the best out of me, so I'm going to give him the best out of me, because then he'll give me the best out of him.
And well, that is true. I probably don't overthink it that much, and for some reason I don't in computer games, but I do in real life.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we don't overthink it. Our brains are, you know, we wire ourselves essentially to do this, and then we act on these things without, you know, we justify our decisions later. We rationalize them after we make them. That's been proven through, you know, fMRI stuff, that, you know, people make decisions and then rationalize them afterwards. And it's because we pre-wire our brain. And so your philosophy and how you do that, you know, how you interpret the world, makes it so that, yeah, I'm the same way. When I play, like, I don't know, they have Star Wars games where you can play light side or dark side. And when I play the dark side, I squirm when I make, you know, decisions that you know, that obviously would be good for dark side stuff, but it just seems petty and horrible. And I put a light side, and I feel much better about it, even though I play as like an angel, and that's not me.
When you play,
it's only okay to kill in Star Wars when you're killing Ewoks.
Right.
And when you play Grand Theft Auto, you take the prostitutes to the to dinner and
yeah, no, you know, they're working too.
Actually, that's the I don't know. You were talking about sex being okay and violence not. I'm thinking I always look for the hookers in games. Mm-hmm. Always, you know, it must be something about that.
I don't know. Grand Theft Auto.
My wife walks in while I'm playing and says, "What are you doing?"
I mean, you bring up Grand Theft Auto, but I think it's a slightly different case, only because there isn't really an option to. I mean, you can, I guess, observe all things, but it would be horribly boring. The game is set up, you know, to reward you for playing, for playing in a certain way.
You couldn't play good and complete any missions,
right?
You know, other than like finding all the hidden stars and stuff, you know.
Yeah. So
you have to walk past the hidden cocaine packages. You couldn't pick those up. So
no, I'm going to turn this into the police. That's all. That's the only reason I'm picking them up.
I don't know. Are you guys, like, I don't know, I'm horribly OCD when playing computer games. Like, if I hate games where there's a collect 100 of these things to get an achievement because I have to do it. It turns out it could be a game into the most boring thing ever.
It kind of depends on the experience. Generally, if I'm having a good time with the game, I will get lost in those collection quests.
That reminds
if I'm not
me.
Having a good time, I will just say, no, I don't want to do this stuff. I'll just, you know, go for it.
That reminds me so much when we went to Denver and you were, you know, playing World of Warcraft, and you had that, he had to get on the computer and do this repetitive thing where he's riding a horse and getting gold coins, and he had to do it for like 45 minutes.
It was
like,
not 45 minutes. It was 12 or 13 minutes.
But it was the most. I was watching him play this, and it was the most repetitive, tedious thing ever.
Yeah, no, that's what it was, and it was not about having fun. It was about the rewards I would get for doing this particular thing over and over again. And the only reason why I was doing it in Denver was because I had to get a certain number of them, and you can only get a certain number per day, and so I had to get those done those days. Yeah, it's
Or you could have gone to Falling Rock and had a beer.
No, I didn't.
Just saying.
Well, there was plenty of beer to be had that day.
Yeah,
so.
No, I didn't particularly like doing those.
Right.
More, you know, any more than you particularly liked watching.
It was more so of the OCD, like where Greg has to go find all the hidden packages. You know, you wanted that the thing, so you had to do this numbingly tedious task. You know,
it was. I wish I didn't have to. And actually circumstances have changed where that situation is no longer doesn't really happen so much anymore in WoW. But so they've built that out of the system. They've realized that sort of thing is not as effective as other ways, you know, because that's what WoW is. It's you know, it's Pavlov's dog, essentially. It's, you know, feeding you little sugar cubes for doing little things, you know, doing short circuiting your reward center. So people are getting better at designing games to to do that simple function.
I heard a great story today. It was about this dad over in China where his son was playing World of Warcraft all the time. He hired some virtual hitmen to kill him anytime his son logged on. It didn't work, though. It didn't stop him from playing. But, yeah, he got these, like, you know, these high-level whatevers to whenever the guy logged on, they'd come in, they'd kill him.
Oh, that's fantastic. Reality fixing a virtual problem. Oh, yeah, I love it.
And it didn't work because it just...
Did he level, then he had to have the urge to play more so we could level up and give them the slip.
Maybe. The part I heard didn't talk about what the son's rationale was. It was just more about the virtual hitmen thing.
I sense a new economy.
Yeah, no, there's...
Well, this is the Chinese students, eh? There's the typical... case that's thrown forward for this, when you were talking about your World of Warcraft, didn't they? They put all these Chinese students that just, there were heaps of them, and they were prepared to do mindless things for tiny amounts of money, so people would pay them to level up their characters.
For what we consider tiny amounts of money, but we're not necessarily.
Well, yeah.
They were more money to them. To us, it's like $1.60.
Yeah.
Like a week or something like that. And then people in the US would pay like $10 for their work. So big markup on just, you know, little bit of money. And
speaking of currency, don't you guys go and strengthen yours up and within the next 3 months. I'm coming over there and I like it cheap.
Wait until we print that $1 trillion coin.
Yeah. That's a whole other thing. Oh boy, economics.
That was what I was going to do if I didn't end up in IT and now brewing, but you know. Oh well. Actually, that's what I should bring you guys when I come. I'll have to make sure I can get some beer.
That would be perfect.
Some of our beer that I can actually send you.
I mean, because we don't get a lot of New Zealand beer. It happens, but it's pretty rare.
So, I mean, the only time we've really had it is when you know, our friend Jeff from Brisbane, you know, when he came up, you know, came to Pittsburgh, he brought, you know, a bunch of Australian beer, but there was, you know, several New Zealand beers in there as well. And
things have changed a lot here in the last probably 3 or 4 years. The beer has exploded. It's just everywhere. We're our own little mini West Coast over here.
That's cool.
The it must be happening everywhere. Pittsburgh. I learned about two new breweries today coming into the area. So I mean, it's like every time you turn around, it's like, oh, there's a new brewery here, a new brewery there. It's
well, it also makes sense because it's one. It's a segment of the economy that's actually growing. It's growing strong. People, it's not, you know, it's not a pie in the sky dream anymore to start up a brewery.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably 10 breweries in planning in the Pittsburgh area at least.
And some of them are going to fail, and that's, you know, it's not going to be the way it used to be where there were one or two, you know, three decent breweries around, and then there were the macros. They're 10 or 15, and you know, just like little restaurants, they fail.
Yeah. From what I saw sort of April, May last year, talking to some of the brewing people in Chicago, they were saying it's not it's a demand issue, but it's a demand – it's constrained by the existing well-known popular brewers. You know, you can start up a new brewery, and unless you do something to really make a name for yourself, you don't necessarily have a market. But meanwhile, places that are well-known are just – they can't keep up. They're buying new stainless steel every week. They're trying to poach brewers from each other, and it's just crazy.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, how do you start that business? How do you get that clientele, right? I have one of my neighbors, you know, he's not a brewer. He knows someone at a wholesaler type thing. So he kind of wants to start one of those beer marketing companies. So he was trying to like run some ideas past me. And, you know, really I wasn't the guy he wanted to talk to because I'm all about the romance of beer, right?
Right.
So, you know, I'm talking about, you know, build your fan base, you know, do something interesting, you know, or he's looking at like, hey, I get some guaranteed tap handles. I get some guaranteed shelf space. You know, what can I do? You know, he's looking at it from the pure beer marketing dollars and pennies, you know, dollars
and cents.
You
need somebody like that in order to grow your business.
But it could be, but it's the same. I mean, he could sell any product that way, right? You know, I mean,
yes.
You know, where the people that are could only do the beer, you know, that the beer makers, you know, the ones that are, you know, passionate about the beer, you know, those are like, so I could have ideas on how,
I'm
I don't
sure I follow.
He's looking at beer as a commodity.
Yeah,
and it could be anything. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, it is a commodity.
Right, right. And he's trying to find, he's trying to find, you know,
it's a luxury commodity, and they're, you
okay.
know.
So he's trying to find what's the sure way to do a commodity, right? Instead of like, how do I
Well, a commodity by definition is cheap, mass produced, and very easy.
Well, that's a fungible commodity.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but not, you know, beer is not necessarily fungible. I mean, I would say that like Miller and Coors are, but it's not necessarily true that all craft beer is fungible. But I think you need that perspective in order to succeed now, more than just, oh, I'm going to make great beer and if people know about it, people know about it. I think you need to have, especially in an expanding market, you need to have somebody who's there to make your whatever it is, make your beer, make your website, make your artisan bread, whatever it is.
Ketchup.
Callback. That's a callback and a half.
That's a 5-year-old callback. to make whatever it is, you need somebody to get that if you want it to grow beyond a certain point.
Go ahead, Greg.
Okay, I was going to say, here's a question for you. Is Miller Coors a beer company or is it a marketing company that happens to sell beer?
So this is tough. So when I talk about a beer marketing company, I typically imagine a company where they own a trademark and they contract brew and, you know, they put most of their resources into marketing their beer. Does that draw a clear enough picture?
Sort of. What I'm getting at is if they weren't producing beer, would they be exactly the same company but producing tires, for example? Is there anything that they do that's a strength because they do beer, I guess is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Would it matter if you swapped out the product they produced?
They wouldn't sell it in the same way. I don't think you can sell tires with naked ladies jumping around, you know, in a beach.
Sure you can.
If you can't, you're not doing it right. If you can't, Greg, you're not doing it right.
You know, or try to mimic craft tires. I don't think that would work either. The realities of the business change with what business you're in, but at the same sense, I mean, they are making a fungible commodity. They are making something that is, you know, essentially just something that can be replaced with something else with a different label.
I'm trying to think about these beer marketing companies, even ones that are making good beer. It's like, so you get the beer made, you get your initial counts, you get it out there. You know, how do you get that consistent rabid fan base, right? You either have to... So which drinker do you want? Do you want the drinker that, you know, drinks solely on experience and taste, or do you want a brand loyal drinker, right? Do you want someone who, you once you get him, you got him for the next 60 years, you know? Because those are generally two very different people, right?
Different markets.
Right, yeah. So you got to figure out which one of the...
In my experience, one becomes the other. They don't stay two separate markets.
One can become the other. One has the potential to become the other, but it doesn't necessarily stay that way. You have to keep reinforcing it.
So if you're going to make...
Exposure. Sorry, I'll go, Jeff.
I was just going to say, if you're going to make, you know... I'm trying to figure out how do I want to describe this product. I was going to say mediocre, but that's really not fair. You're going to make your beer. And your goal is, I'm going to get my drinker base by marketing to them and make them lifelong drinkers, right? That's very different from, I'm going to make the best beer I can, or, you know, the most, you know, something. So think about, you know, a different brewery, like, say, Russian River. How'd Russian River get their name? They didn't necessarily get their name from making the sour beers. That came later. But they got their name from making, you know, very... out there, interesting, extreme beers, right? And they grew their market, you know, they grew the local market, then they got a reputation, then they had this, you know, aura about them, you know?
And the principle behind, I think, the making, the construction of whatever you're doing is different. For, I think that, you know, in the craft beer market, generally, I think that in niches of like entertainment and artisan stuff, you find that the people who are doing the crafty stuff are people who are making things that they want to make and hope, and they're just making it really for them, and other people share their tastes. Whereas the Miller Coors, they're making something for a particular market. They may be able to, like the people, like, you know, Florian at Budweiser may be able to adjust his taste to
that urban chestnut.
He was at Budweiser. May be able to adjust their taste to go along those lines, but he's not necessarily making the beer he wants to make. He's making the beer that will sell the best. He's making the commodity that will sell the best.
Yep. So what you've just done is touched on exactly why I asked you that question, which is, I mean, I see you're having the big debate over there. Is it the Brewers Association starting the fight about craft beer? Yeah. Same thing's happening over here. Although it's more a reaction to what the Brewers Association has done in the States rather than anything coming out of our own Brewers Guild or anything similar. And it's really dividing people. And people are talking about, you know, what craft beer is. And the strange thing here is that no one seems to like the Craft Brewers Association over their definition of it. No, and most people I know that love beer say, look, if a brewery produces an amazing beer and they do it because they want to make an amazing beer, why isn't that a craft beer? Hence the question about, you know, could you change that company into producing tires? And so, would it still be a beer company?
So here's a question for you, Greg.
Which Greg? You,
Greg in New Zealand, Greg McGill.
So you, oh, hi!
What you just said was if a big company wants to produce a craft beer or wants to produce an amazing beer, right, or a good beer, then, you know, they're producing a good beer. What if they want to produce a really good beer, not because they want to produce a really good beer, but just because there's a market segment that they can get a share of?
But does it matter?
Still a really good beer, right?
Yeah. I mean, does it matter and should it matter? Should anybody care?
I mean,
is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. But yeah, should anyone care, right? Because, I mean, okay, so local brewery X starts making really good beer. How much, what percentage, because it's not 100% either way, which percentage of their motivation is because they love really good beer? And which percentage is, hey, there's actually a market that will buy my beer, right?
Yeah, I think the two are.
I mean, that's
horrible stuff.
That's the same thing that Anheuser-Busch or whatever, you know, the big breweries are doing. Hey, there's a market that'll buy this stuff. Let's make it. You know, here for the small brewer, it's, hey, I really want to make my beer, but hey, I'm going to make a business because there's a market that will buy it.
Yes.
You know, it's the same part for both breweries.
Right.
One's just established and growing into a market, and one is incorporating to fill a market.
Right.
You know?
So I think that there is, you know, this actually does link all the way back to the original point, the original discussion, because I think that there is, you know, you're drawing a fine black and white distinction between a marketing company and a craft company, or at least you're asking, is there a black and white distinction? And I think that Jeff and I are saying no. There's a scale. There's a gradient. You can, you know, be more of one, be more of another, but there's nothing that's all the way tipped on one or all the way tipped on the other.
I mean, to maybe clarify my point a little bit more about beer marketing companies, how do you get from the point where you have one, maybe two beers and a few tap handles in a small market? How do you get out of there? That's what kind of what this guy was asking me, right? How do you turn into Boston Beer Company? I mean, maybe not that big, but how do you turn into a successful? How do you turn into Hebrew?
You know, how does any company grow and become?
Because I mean, that's you know, actually, there's an example of a beer marketing company, a beer company. They don't brew, They have labels. They make good beer. They make a lot of good beers. They make beers that beer geeks will seek out. How do you go from, you know, having one or two beers and a few tap handles to Schmaltz Brewing Company with Jeremy Cowan and Hebrew Brewing? You know, how do you get to that point? It's very...
How do you go from being a little podcast to a big one? How do you, you know, I mean,
yeah. It's the same question.
Yeah. How does Greg go from, you know, a small YouTube thing where he's reviewing beers to, you know, a show on Nerdist?
I don't, because if I ever did, I'd probably kill myself.
Hookers and Co. Hookers and Blow.
Hookers and Blow. Yeah.
But, yeah, so there's a saturation point in the market. There's luck. There's ingenuity. There's, you know, people who are pounding the pavement. There are people who have relationships with other people to get themselves in the right place at the right time. The people who get into publicity outright. There's you have to be smart at all those things to be successful.
I do think with beer, quality will out, and quality for me, consistency is a big part of that. And it's one thing that breweries over here are really struggling with. You know, it's very hard. I've often thought about sending you guys a case of beer. And every time I do, I think, oh, how do I know it's good? How do I know that these bottles are the same as the ones I bought last week? And it's one thing I noticed in the States is consistency seems to be not a solved problem, but certainly a lot better. Like every time I have a beer, it tastes the way I remember it, and it's always good.
We have an example, like Weyerbacher's example of a company that did not make – had really poor standards and –
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a consistency thing so much. They make better beer. That goes back to the point of, you know, the essay I wanted to make last year. I talked about it briefly, but I never actually made the essay. And that is basically the subject title would have been, where have all the shitty beers gone, right? Because generally beers are good. There still is a consistency problem. I mean, there's recently on the show we've had to pour out beers because they've had packaging problems.
But as there are more companies that produce beer, you expect there to be, you know, a wider distribution of problems. So,
I think the game is lifting as quickly as the distribution's growing.
Absolutely,
which is great to see.
And technology is getting better and cheaper. You know, it's cheaper to get easier sanitation technology and better and you know, cheap bottling lines that are effective. You don't have to get an old one that you have to constantly be tweaking and that may have, you know, fungus growing in it.
Actually, part of that might be that there's like such a demand for brewing equipment. Like East End Brewing, when they got their new brewery, they bought a new brewery because
as demand rises, cost drops.
Used stuff, you know, he sold his stuff to a broker immediately. The price for used stuff is not that much of a discount off the new stuff. You know, I mean, there's such demand for brewing equipment out there that. And the wait times are crazy. He still has their old keg washer, you know. He's like, there's like an 8-month lead time on keg washers.
Man, well, so I need to send you guys a photo of our bottling line. That's the brewery.
That I think is the answer. That's the answer, Jeff. I think that the answer is to look not to where the market is getting saturated, but to where the market isn't saturated. People need the brewing equipment. That's where you go. If you have 100 breweries coming up, you don't become 101 breweries. You become the person that supplies the brewing equipment to each of those 100 breweries.
That's actually a great idea. I mean, problem for you and me doing it is there's a lot of capital.
There's a lot of capital
and a lot of expertise needed to do that. That's no small startup, but you know, there could actually be a market for starting a new brewing equipment company. You know.
One thing we see here is there's a lot of broker companies around, and what they will do is they'll go to China, where there's a lot of great stuff being made, but also a lot of terrible stuff being made, and they will do all the footwork for you. They'll source the good stuff. They'll make the personal relationships with the Chinese manufacturers, and then you talk to the broker, and they mark it up by 150%, and it's still fairly cheap. And you get a great product for less than you would have paid from a well-known source, and it's, you know, it's all well, you've got the stamp, everything on it. It's great.
Chinese brew house.
Yeah, there's been a few horror stories as well.
I'm sure.
There's just a little bit of lead in our beer.
Well, there's not just that, but I mean, there's a lot of There's a lot of nuance into how a brew house is configured and how even how the kettle is configured, right? And, you know, the German manufacturers have been doing it for centuries, you know? So you can imagine, you know, imagine the corporate, you know, the industrial espionage there, right? Like Chinese steel brewery plans and clone them just like computer chips.
You guys are like this, bringing it full circle back to where we came in. So that, there's these brokers. One thing they don't always realize is that there's safety regulatory standards that differ between China and here. So we had one example of a company that bought in a steam-fired kettle, and it wasn't rated for the pressure that it needed to be here. So they were out of production for nearly a year while they got this thing brought up to standard. It ended up costing them a fortune.
Had to retrofit the whole kettle, probably. I mean,
yeah.
Another reason why legislation can help sometimes.
Except the thing is, see, what got me about this is that these kettles are used everywhere. They've got some in the States, they've got some in Canada, they've got them all over the place. We happen to have a more stringent safety regulation, but no one's ever died from any of the others. So do they suddenly become not safe because they're here?
Well, that's like baby cribs and car seats, right? You can't use a car seat that's 5 years old because it's not safe enough anymore.
Yeah. Right. You still could. You're allowed to.
No one's going to arrest you for doing it. Just you'll be a bad parent.
You'll just be a bad parent. But, you know, but companies are not allowed to sell 5-year-old baby seats, you know, if they're like, I don't know, larger than 50 people. So, I mean, you know, there's some sort
of... Well, no, you can't even sell them at the church rummage sale.
Really?
No. Nope.
Is it just the people... Is it illegal to sell them?
You can't sell, like, our crib, the crib that Allison and Max grew up in. Heather could not sell that on Craigslist.
Well, not being able to sell it is different than...
No, not allowed to sell it. They will not let you post the old cribs on Craigslist.
But there are outlets where you could sell it. You would not be violating the law by selling it to, say, your friend across the street.
No, I don't know if you're violating the law. You may be.
You'd have to look it up, I guess. There's no way.
I doubt you'd be violating the law by doing that, but you would be a very bad parent, or at least you would you would be putting your parenting skills into question. I mean, if you knew this was pristine, period.
Like every once in a while, you'll see these cribs up on, you know, Craigslist, whatever, and they'll be like, "This is for the wood only, not for putting babies in."
Uh huh.
Just like buying the bottle,
beer. Buying bottles instead of beer, right? So you're working your way around legislation, but the same, you know, I guess it is technically illegal for me to buy a 6-pack and then give you the 6-pack and have you give me the money for it. In Pennsylvania, it's probably technically illegal, but there's no enforcement to check on that. So I don't think that there's, you know,
I don't know about that. I mean, that's what we do at work, right?
Right.
We have the beer club. I buy a bunch of cases of beer, mix up the 6-packs, and then people buy individual 6-packs off me at face value. I make no profit. I thought that would have been okay, but maybe not.
Can retailers there sell you a mixed case?
The
some can. The ones that have
20%
food.
Well, we're getting into the whole. Yeah. So there's
it's Pennsylvania law. It's not American law.
I realize, but it's still weird.
No, Pennsylvania has two different places you can buy beer, which they have two different kinds of licenses, but which has really evolved into three different kinds of places. There is what we call the beer distributor, but beer store. And this is a store that can sell it's defined by ounces. I guess it's like 144 ounces. So they can sell 12 bombers now. A couple years ago, they couldn't sell 12 bombers. They could sell 12 750s. But like, if you wanted to buy in bombers, you had to buy 2 12 packs of bombers. So you could imagine anything packaged in a bomber like Arrogant Bastard was crazy expensive because you'd have to buy 24 of them. They changed the law a couple years ago, so 12 bombers was now a case of beer.
Still pretty expensive.
Yeah. So those those beer stores...
So they differentiate by brand, though, that is what I'm getting at. So you can't go in and buy a case that they've assembled that has the requisite amount of beer in it, but from 12 different breweries.
Well, the cases can't be opened by the distributor.
Yeah, the cases can't be opened. So the wholesaler sometimes, like Vicini, the one wholesaler here in Pittsburgh, because Pittsburgh has the case law and other states don't, one thing they'll do for their breweries is they will assemble variety packs for the brewery. And so you like Cellus, mm-hmm. like you can get the Cellus variety pack, which is made at Vicini actually. They don't do that for very many, but you know, like Bell's is another Vicini beer, and Bell's has a case that's a variety pack. They probably don't sell, like a lot of those things are probably like mostly go to Pennsylvania, you know? So there's the beer stores, what we call the distributors. But distributors is a misnomer. It's a double-loaded term because the wholesalers are also distributors. And then the only other license is like a tavern license. And the requirements for that is that you can drink beer on premise. You can buy up to 12-ounce bottles to go. It has to serve food, and it has to have 30 seats. So that's the other kind of place you can buy beer in Pennsylvania. And over the last 3 or 4 years, I guess, grocery stores have started buying tavern licenses and outfitting their cafes to sell beer. So the big grocery market chain here in Pittsburgh is Giant Eagle. And, you know, their cafes have beer coolers and they have the seats and they have the food. So they meet those requirements and they have a tavern license. But when you're grocery shopping, you pick up your beer, you go to the cash register at the cafe and pay for your beer. And then you go grocery shopping with a beer in your shopping cart that says paid, and you buy the rest of your food and go to the other cash register.
Right.
Okay. This gives me a headache, but it really does underline that no one should be allowed to make law just like that.
So,
well, I mean, what you're seeing is you're seeing actually the reason why this is taking place is because the beer distributors, the people we call the beer distributors, have their market kind of sealed, and they have a lobby now.
Oh, one other thing: the beer distributors cannot sell like fresh fruit. So, like, if you want to, so they have like at the beer distributor, they have beer, they have potato chips, they have pretzels. They can't sell limes to go with the Corona.
But anyway, so you have a built-in, you already have a lobby who's lobbying for them. Not, to, I mean, the point here is new legislation would help to, you know, to open this, but it's being resisted by on one end the puritanical people who, you know, have some, you know, are against alcohol completely. On the other hand, the beer distributors who are profiting off the fact that, you know, they can sell, you know, their business model would have to change and have to do a whole bunch of stuff. And so they
we talked about this a little bit before. You know, I would have liked, the beer distributors wanted no change. They liked the low overhead of selling cases of beer until Giant Eagle started selling six packs. And then I remember there was a petition at the beer distributor to let beer distributors sell six packs. And I didn't sign it. I'm like, fuck you. You didn't want to sell six packs when it would have been good for the consumer. You just want to sell six packs because you're getting pressure from the grocery stores, you know, too little too late.
Hey guys, I don't know if you've seen me frantically gesturing at my wife off camera here. She's just reminding me that I'm meeting people down the pub, so I better go. Before I go, I'll leave you with one thought, which is one of the local libertarian guys over here came up with a good idea, and that was that he said, no one should be allowed to introduce a new law without first getting rid of an old one. So you guys should bring that in and start working on getting rid of some of these beer laws if you want some more gun control.
You know, I was actually thinking,
I wouldn't be opposed to that necessarily.
I was thinking about something very similar the other day. It's like, you know, if I like ran for Congress, you know, like I would run on a platform of like, you know, repealing stupid laws.
Yeah.
You know, like just go through the books and just like say, I'm going to go through and my mission will be to remove, you know, the silly, inane laws, but also just find bad laws, you know?
No, you got my vote, but I don't know if
I'll move there and become a citizen just so I can vote for you, Jeff.
Well, Greg,
hey guys, it's been fun. I got to go.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you what the lottery numbers are tomorrow.
Oh, well, of course. 1, 19, 33, 26, 15, and 4.
All right, there
you go. But he didn't tell you for which country.
No. Well, play them all and see what happens.
It's already been 8 p.m. Oh, no, it's yesterday. Right, never mind. Okay, guys, have a good show.
Thanks so much for joining us, Greg. It was really a pleasure. Our pleasure.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
All right, well.
That's enough pre-show, I think. An hour and 14 minutes.
Kind of a long one, but a good one. Yeah. I hope, you know, if anybody else would like to join us for these, I mean, that's a lot of
guest
fun.
Guest pre-shows? Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And, you know, we always appreciate having another voice along with us. We'd love to have people here for the show, but it's harder to get people. But pre or post show, it's easy. We'll see you on the main.